KALW.
You can have free-flowing traffic, you can have a wastewater infrastructure system, and you can have a sandy beach. You can sort of have any two of those three, but you really can't have them all.
The Great Highway at Ocean Beach will be closed for the next couple of months because of erosion.
What we see at Ocean Beach today is a condition that we're likely to see much more broadly as serious consequences of sea level rise set in.
We'll meet the urban designers working on a major climate change solution. Then an interview with one of the founders of Burning Man about the year that changed everything.
I think by then it was doubling in size every year. And I knew we were headed for a disaster. There's no way around it.
And get ready for Thanksgiving dinner with an award-winning San Francisco chef.
Kind of a classic stuffing, but with an addition of gizzards.
Sounds good to me. I'm Hena Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Access improvements, structural protection, managed retreat. Those may sound like military terms, because they are. But they also describe what's happening at San Francisco's Ocean Beach right now in a biennial battle that the city is waging against Mother Nature. Yesterday, huge dump trucks began hauling massive loads of sand. They're traveling from the north end of the beach near the beach chalet, 2.5 miles down the Great Highway to the intersection of Sloat Boulevard, which is eroding fast. It's requiring the closure of the southbound thoroughfare every weekday from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m., and it'll happen until January. By the end of the operation, the Public Utility Commission expects to move 100,000 tons of sand. And then, in a couple of years, once the tides and wind have had their way, they'll probably have to do it again, because they've had to just about every 2 years since 2012. Audrey Dilling reported on the operation back in 2016. Here's that story.
In this war, San Francisco's tanks look more like Tonka trucks. The dump trucks line up along the beach. A machine with a huge scoop at the end fills each one up with sand. Then they turn around and head south in an orderly procession. They dump the sand and turn around and come back. They're doing this until they've moved all the sand they need to move, which is a lot of sand.
Well, we have a calculation of about 37,000 tons. So we're going to do about 1,000 truckloads in the course of the next few weeks.
Gene Walsh is with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, or SFPUC. The point is to protect a water treatment plant the SFPUC operates down near Sloat Boulevard. There's a pipe there that releases treated wastewater into the ocean. The sand surrounding the pipe plays a big role in protecting it from being battered by waves. But the ocean currents have a habit of sweeping that sand miles away, all the way up to the beach where Walsh and I are standing, leaving the area around the plant vulnerable.
Just a couple weeks ago, we saw another 4 feet of that parking lot down there by Sloat fall off the cliff, basically. So, it's just a constant battle.
It really is a battle. There are even ruins. The erosion has exposed a couple of old seawalls and the remnants of a pedestrian tunnel built about 100 years ago. Artifacts from times we've tried to hold off the sea and failed. But in the case of the sewer plant, we can't give up.
Well, we would never let this happen. So worst case scenario, if that got exposed and somehow ruptured, we'd have a sewage spill into the Pacific Ocean.
The wastewater plant was built in 1993. Soon after that, the city noticed the erosion problem and responded aggressively, installing concrete barriers around the pipe and along the beach. The barriers worked, but environmentalists and beach visitors weren't happy about the jagged blocks cluttering the shoreline. Meanwhile, storms continued to ravage the coastline south of Sloat. So the city tried to get a permit to build more barriers, but the California Coastal Commission denied it and said they needed a new strategy. Hence the dump trucks. They first showed up in 2012.
I never remembered them doing this at all when I was growing up. So.
Pierre Braganza is a civilian bystander in this war. He grew up out here in the Sunset District.
I've been out here my whole life, and it's funny because, you know, the stairs, I remember as a kid, you used to run down these stairs and it was kind of long.
Nowadays, you don't even need the stairs sometimes because the sand is piled so high.
You know, I guess you gotta, you know, be a little bit proactive or else nature would probably just take over everything, you know?
A lot of this area actually used to belong to the sea. Early San Franciscans pushed the beach about 200 feet west to level out dunes and make room for the Great Highway, the road that runs parallel to the shoreline. And ever since, the ocean has been trying to advance its way back, eroding the land under the road or covering it with enough sand that it often needs to be closed and cleared out during windy months. The city knows this, which is why the dump trucks aren't a permanent solution.
You can have free-flowing traffic, you can have a wastewater infrastructure system, and you can have a sandy beach. You can sort of have any two of those three, but you really can't have them all.
Benjamin Grant is Urban Design Policy Director for the city planning think tank SPUR, and he's landed himself in the position of Commander-in-Chief of San Francisco's long-term battle plan against erosion and sea level rise. For the past 5 years, Grant and his army of SPUR staff have been concocting a strategy that takes everyone's needs into account: environmental agencies, beach visitors, wildlife. It's called the Ocean Beach Master Plan. Grant says they had three main tactics to choose from. One, coastal armoring,
which stops the erosion, but also often degrades the landscape or the beach.
Like what the SFPUC already tried with the concrete barriers. Two, a full-on attack, padding the beach with a lot more sand to make it wider and hold off the ocean. That's like what the dump trucks are doing. Not a good long-term solution. So SPUR has landed on a third option.
What's called managed retreat, which is essentially realigning threatened assets away from the erosion hazard.
In other words, we're giving the land back to the sea. Well, parts of it. The problem stretch of the Great Highway south of Slope Boulevard, the plan says that should go away as soon as 2020. And with traffic gone, the area returned to a natural coastal landscape. There will still be some protections around the treatment plant, but they won't need to work as hard, thanks to the other adaptations. At least, that's the idea. The Ocean Beach Master Plan is a series of recommendations that all need to get their own green light, by the city or the Coastal Commission, or for some of them, both. Grant says that'll take work, but if it gets passed, it would be huge.
The Ocean Beach Master Plan is one of the first examples of a specific location having a detailed long-term climate adaptation plan.
That means it could become a model for other areas.
What we see at Ocean Beach today is a condition that we're likely to see much more broadly in 50 and 100 years.
The science supports this. A recent study found that seas rose at a faster rate in the last century than in any of the 27 before it.
So if we can develop the tools and techniques and planning processes to adapt at places like Ocean Beach, we'll be able to apply those tools much more broadly as the serious consequences of sea level rise set in.
At Ocean Beach, Jean Walsh from the SFPUC says she's on board with the plan and ready to retreat.
So we're saying, let the ocean take what it wants, and let's bow out gracefully and put our road back there where it's safe. We don't have to fight this battle every year.
So so Mother Nature is winning right now?
Yeah, I would say so.
And then in down the line in, say, 50 years, we'll be sort of at a truce, maybe?
I hope so. After a lot of money spent and a lot of thought put into it, and hopefully we'll come up with a sustainable long-term plan that works for everyone.
Including the ocean. In San Francisco, I'm Audrey Dilling for Cross Currents.
You'll find dump trucks rolling up and down the Great Highway for the rest of the year as part of the Ocean Beach Master Plan. And eventually, the idea is to remove the Great Highway between Slote and Skyline Boulevard. Find more information about all this at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Now, if we go up the coast, we'll find Baker Beach. That is where Burning Man first started back in 1986. It started small and grew exponentially over the next decade. 1996 was a turning point. By this time, attendance was around 8,000. Two people were run over in their tents, and another person died in a head-on collision during pre-event building. The event takes place on federal land in Nevada's Black Rock Desert, and the Bureau of Land Management didn't renew the permit. It all could have ended there. Instead, organizers moved the event temporarily to private land and tried to tame the chaos with a bunch of new rules and a grid of new roads. But there was one key person missing, co-founder John Law. He knew Burning Man couldn't continue as it was, but he chafed at the taming of the event that he helped start, so he walked away. As part of our ongoing series, The Intersection at Burning Man, KALW's managing editor David Boyer sat down with John to talk about the origins of the event and how it fits into the larger history of counterculture in the Bay Area.
They turn the Melvins off.
Yeah.
All right. Hey.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good to meet you.
Likewise. Yeah. KLW, are we doing good work?
Yeah.
You know, let's get you comfortable. I can put, there's a chair.
Okay.
Which, right here. It'll be a little cramped.
It's okay. Do you don't mind?
Yeah.
You don't mind, I don't mind.
So
hey. I'm going to start with a story.
Oh, very good.
So for me, the story starts in 96. Because I went out there, had no idea what I was going to.
Yeah, that's the best.
The whole experience felt like, oh, this is what it is. I didn't know anything that was going on.
And I think by then it was doubling in size every year. And I knew we were headed for a disaster. There's no way around it. I mean, I knew there were going to be 10,000 people there that year. 95 was real close. I mean, you know, there were a couple of minor injuries. Nobody got killed. But it was obvious. And we had to get a bigger, we had to be more controlling. We had to be have more cops, more accountants, more this, more that. And we didn't. You know, we had very little money and very little resources. And honestly, some people involved in organizing the event weren't that worried about that, you know. And other people, you know, just wanted to build it in any way, shape, or form. There are a couple other people involved, Larry primarily, who wanted to grow the event regardless. I mean, no matter what. Grow.
He's talking about co-founder Larry Harvey, who's the person most associated with Burning Man.
Kept saying, like, we shouldn't be advertising it. We should be, like, not to keep people from coming, just to keep let it grow more organically.
Back in 96, there were no addresses, no alphabet of streets in concentric circles around the man. There was just a center camp where, like now, you couldn't buy much more than coffee and ice.
So there was that schism between freedom, anarchy, and control. And, you know, I find control boring. Control won out because it just does.
To say he found control boring is an understatement. Before Burning Man, John spent more than a decade at the center of the Bay Area's underground anarchist culture.
I don't feel particularly exceptional. I feel like I fell down a rabbit hole in 1976, and I just feel like I was lucky in the right place, right time, with a bad attitude. Because when I came here at 17 in 1976 looking for the party, and all the toothless hippie drug addicts told me the party was over, and I just went on and did what I was doing and met all these other people, we made our own party.
That party began with the Suicide Club, a secret society that was one of the first extreme urban exploration groups.
Going in a sewer is pretty cool, you know, to me. Climbing a bridge is pretty cool. For the first year of the Suicide Club, we'd go in a sewer, we'd climb a Golden Gate Bridge, we'd go sledding down the letters of South San Francisco, we'd do something really weird, and then like at 2 in the morning or at dawn, we'd pick up our lunch pails and go, okay, see you next time, pal.
The party continued with the Cacophony Society, another underground social group that made an art of transgression and trespassing. But this one was a little less secret.
So there were a bunch of articles about Cacophony. What would happen, like, we'd have an article in the Examiner or the Chronicle or something, and 10 or 20 new people would show up at our monthly meeting, like at Edinburgh Castle or Tommy's Joint or something. Then they'd come on some event, and like, out of those 10 people, like, 9 of them would go running away in abject horror. That was kind of how you separate the wheat from the chaff or whatever.
Both Cacophony and Suicide Club were progenitors of Burning Man and part of the rich underground countercultural history of the Bay Area.
What I'm hoping to get at is the philosophical underpinnings of it.
Well, the philosophical underpinnings of Burning Man, the beach event was basically a bonfire with a bunch of people drinking beer. First on the desert, there were 70 people. And so it's this weird thing, like people think it was some like magical, mystical, amazing. I mean, it was cool, but we didn't have much infrastructure. And we knew that it was a place where was total freedom. We could do whatever we wanted to, and that was important. It was not an elaborate thing. That sort of thing came later. The philosophy or underpinnings of the event came from a long-standing, very involved and engaged San Francisco underground history going back decades. Okay, we're influenced by the Suicide Club and Cacophony Society came out of a group called Communiversity, which is a free university movement in the 60s. And Communiversity was free. You'd exchange goods, ideas, classes, information for free. So it's a radical idea in a commodified culture. It's still a radical idea. And the initial culture that Burning Man came out of came from that directly. Later, there were a couple things that were quite important. Kerry Galbraith, who was one of the main organizers in Cacophony, came up with the concept of the zone trip. The idea was that the zone was a place you'd go, and anything could happen. You could go there and be enlightened. You could go there and maybe die. When we did the first zone trip, which was to L.A. in 88, we drove down. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. We stopped at a random spot that she just felt embodied the entryway to the zone. We stopped, drew a line in the dirt, and stepped across it. L.A.'s a weird enough place, but if you put that into your brain, it's like you're in an alien universe. The next 2.5-3 days were just like that. So Burning Man on the Desert was the fourth zone trip. Bad Day at Black Rock, Cacophony Society Zone Trip number 4.
It's tempting to make a neat timeline of Burning Man's history, but the reality is messier and reflects a lot of collaboration. What became Burning Man started as a bonfire on Baker Beach, where Larry Harvey and some friends drank beer and burned a wooden effigy of a man, a stick figure, really. That became a summer solstice tradition. The term Burning Man didn't exist until 1988. And technically, that first year in the desert in 1990, that was not an event called Burning Man either. Cacophony Society had invited Larry Harvey to burn his wooden effigy at their zone trip event. That's after the cops stopped him from torching it on Baker Beach. And that's how Burning Man and the rest of us ended up at the Black Rock Desert.
We drove out 100 feet on the playa, drew a line in the dirt, stepped over it, then got into our vehicles. There were about 30 people, and we drove out randomly to a point out in the middle of nowhere.
So I guess what I'm curious about is, whether it's Cacophony Society or whatever, what's gluing you guys together?
Elena Fronte, who was one of the major organizers of the Suicide Club, earliest iteration, was in the 70s, and you know, she said, yeah, you can find a guy in any bar in town, but finding a real weirdo is difficult, really difficult. Because there was no online forum. You know, if you're interested in transbachelian swallows and their flight patterns, right, you're never going to find another person who's interested in that. With the internet, you'll find 100 of them, almost guaranteed, or maybe 50 of them, okay? But in 1977, you couldn't. There was no way to connect with people. So when you ran into a person who wanted to do odd stuff, who was willing to take these risks, who saw the world saw the environment as a playground, that was a special thing. You found a special person.
Concurrently, something else was emerging that ultimately changed Burning Man and, well, civilization as we know it. It's called the World Wide Web.
By that time, Burning Man and other cacophony events and other stuff in general was starting to break out and to become cultural memes, which we didn't understand at the time, because of our proximity to the rise of the internet culture right here in the Bay Area. And by the time that stuff busted out, it just happened to be that we were the people next to the Silicon Valley doing all these weird events, Burning Man being the, you know, 800-pound gorilla in the room, and it blew up because of that, like really blew up because of that. And in particular, Burning Man became the sanctioned corporate vacation for Silicon Valley over time, because it started out with the real interesting folks who were really exploring culture, who would go to, you know, to this early iteration of Burning Man and really trip out, oh my God, like you, I mean, trip out on it, like this is great. And then invite all their friends who were in tech, and the corporations realize, oh wow, this is really valuable. And like all throughout history, you know, it's very important for control to have a sanctioned vacation that all their workers can go to and get naked, paint themselves blue, drop acid, f*** somebody they just met for a week, and then go back to work in their cubicle for the rest of the year.
So how did we get from there to here? And what does John think about what's become of Burning Man? Go to theintersection.fm to hear the rest of that story, or subscribe to the Intersection podcast on your podcast player. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. In a couple of days, families across the country will sit down for a Thanksgiving dinner made up of, well, a lot of the same dishes. But the exact recipes can be very different and varied. San Francisco chef Tracy Desjardins draws inspiration from her multicultural childhood in the Central Valley for a feast that'll make your mouth water. KELW's Lisa Morehouse visited Desjardins a few years ago in her home kitchen for some tasty recommendations.
I asked Tracy Desjardins to demonstrate one favorite Thanksgiving dish for this story. But when I get to her house, she's making four.
One dish.
Yeah, it's Thanksgiving. Can't do one dish for Thanksgiving. For God's sakes, you're lucky I didn't do like 10.
I'm not complaining.
She starts with stuffing, preparing the mirepoix, or vegetable mixture of celery, onions, and leeks.
Cutting up the onion. Kind of a classic stuffing, but with an addition of gizzards and chanterelles and roasted chestnuts. So I'm going to sweat the mirepoix in just a little bit of butter until it's nice and soft.
Desjardins readily admits she's always been a bit over the top when it comes to food. She started baking at age 3 and was soon micromanaging her cousins over cookie batter.
And I was always yelling at everybody about folding the flour in gently because otherwise it was going to make the cookies tough. And they just thought I was insane. They hated me.
She comes to that obsession honestly. Growing up in a family of rice farmers in the Central Valley town of Firebaugh, Desjardins learned to cook from all 4 grandparents who lived nearby.
My Mexican grandpa used to make menudo, which he was relegated to do in the garage.
Desjardins' grandmother, who made fresh tortillas every day, didn't want the smell of tripe cooking in the house. On the other side of the family, Desjardins' Scandinavian grandmother baked breads and sweets. Her grandfather, originally from Lake Charles, Louisiana, led the family in collecting crawdads in the Central Valley's canal systems.
We go out and harvest huge trash cans full of crawdads and do a big crawdad boil.
And the Desjardins would hunt the wild ducks drawn to the farm's rice paddies.
I can remember always walking to the kitchen, the smell of wild ducks cooking and like stewed like red wine sauce.
Everyone in her family cooked.
It was just, you know, it was part of the fabric of our family.
So Thanksgiving was and is a big deal.
Let me check it. Looks pretty good. Smells good.
This is my first taste of stuffing with duck gizzards. Mmm.
Delicious, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, it just tastes like duck fat. Nothing wrong with that.
Desjardins dropped out of college at age 17 to cook professionally, and she jokes that she did 2 tours of duty in notoriously tough French kitchens. But this might comfort home cooks out there. She says she always burns bread, and she passes gravy-making duty on to her mom.
When she's not with me on Thanksgiving, I have to make the gravy, and I hate it. I really don't know how civilians pull Thanksgiving off. I feel for y'all out there.
Desjardins' childhood Thanksgivings meant all hands on deck.
Traditionally, my family made a 4 or 5 day affair out of Thanksgiving.
The family cooked whole animals outdoors, leaving the indoor kitchen for everything else. And side dishes from her childhood reappear, though some, like Brussels sprouts, have evolved.
I wasn't very fond of Brussels sprouts when I was a kid, and I absolutely adore them now.
These are pan-roasted, finished in browned butter with whole grain mustard and sherry. The one dish Desjardins doesn't change at all is her grandmother's consommé rice, starting with the short grain white rice her family grew.
I'm browning it in whole butter, so it's getting nice and toasty. It has kind of a nutty, aromatic smell right now.
Then a liquid combination of water and Campbell's beef consomme.
Put the liquid in and bring it up to a boil. And then turn it all the way down and cover it and let it cook for 20 minutes. And don't take the lid off while it's cooking. As if you really need one more starch for your Thanksgiving dinner. But this was just one of those things that we couldn't do without. Okay, I'm going to make you a plate.
As we sit at the little table in her kitchen, eating the stuffing, Brussels sprouts, consomme rice, and a bright salad of fall fruits, frisée, and watercress, it's clear. Desjardins made four dishes, not just because she's an overachiever, but because all of these flavors work together on the plate.
The Brussels sprouts, right?
They're great.
The spirit of this, you know, Thanksgiving out in the country is very much like how I grew up. You eat leftovers and you go for long walks. And last year we foraged for mushrooms the day after. And, you know, and the quality of time that you spend together. And, you know, it's 4 days of hanging out and eating. What's better than that? For me, that's really kind of what Thanksgiving's about.
Next week, years of the finest culinary experience and family tradition will come together on Tracy Desjardins' Thanksgiving table. I'm Lisa Morehouse in San Francisco.
That story originally aired in 2012 on KQED's California Report. You can hear more of Lisa's food stories on her podcast called California Foodways or at klw.org. Tune in tomorrow at 5. People have been bugging out about a possible monarch butterfly extinction.
Maybe everything had just a terrible year statewide. We wouldn't know because nobody's been looking.
Beyond the Butterfly, tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Precious Green, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Sarah Lye Sterlin. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as reinterpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.